I think 12 months from now, the timeline to access generative structures will compress radically, predictive tools will get better, and all of it will be agentically orchestrated. 10 years from now is going to be wild. There are going to be so many more molecules being developed and being ready for clinical testing than prior generations that I think it's going to call for a real reconsideration of how we move things through the clinic and how we capitalize the whole industry. It's really an incredible opportunity.
Jacob, thanks for joining us on Transcribed.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about Terray? I'd love to hear the founding story of the company.
Of course. Terray is really a journey of hardware innovation, data revolution, and AI transformation. It started all the way back in my academic lab where me and my co-founders developed novel hardware. It's a little ultra-dense microarray the size of a fingernail, and it lets you measure billions of interactions between small molecules and targets of interest. And so with that data set, we can map dark areas of chemical space, find starting points others can't. And we've connected that now to a full stack AI that's able to reason, generate structures against a desired profile, predict the properties of those structures, and then select the optimal ones for testing. And so we work on a pipeline of wholly owned assets and one co-development with Odyssey focused on immunology. And we're on the cusp of the clinic next year. And then we also solve problems for others in our partnership business, which includes Calico, Gilead, and BMS. And delighted to be here and tell the Terray story, which is really one of being at that intersection of experimentation and AI to bring transformative medicines to patients in need.
So you are a hardcore scientist who spent years in academia. Eli was in private equity. Did you ever expect to start a company with your brother? Was that the master plan? And what's it like to work together?
I don't know if it was the master plan. I think our entire lives, we were obviously great friends and good partners, and we hoped maybe there was something we could do together besides like trade baseball cards. But this one really arose serendipitously where the opportunity was there. We had the right overlapping skills, and there's no one I trust more to develop something with than my brother. So I was able to bring him on, and it's been a great ride.
What was the elevator pitch that convinced him to join you?
Yeah, my brother, as you noted, worked in private equity, came from GSB. So all finance world. I came from the academic background, all chemistry.
You're a professor, right?
Yeah, my background was synthetic chemistry all the way through my academic training at various different institutes. And then I was a professor where we invented the underlying technology. And so over the course of the 6 years that we built the technology in academia, we'd see each other at Thanksgiving and catch up on the weekend. And I was like, oh, we got this incredible new project in the lab. Like, you got to get in on this. And he was like, well, like, but does it like work? And I was like, no, but it's like an amazing idea. It's going to be so good. And so he stayed close over the years. And, every meeting, they're like, well, now this part works. And so it's so close. And then finally, it really, really worked and was ready to scale. And, the sales pitch is, I think, easy, but also hard for life sciences, which is like, this is an incredible opportunity to help the world. It's an opportunity to make a tremendous impact, improve people's lives, and make a bunch of money doing it, which obviously is the intersection of all of our interests. And so that opportunity to really change people's lives in a positive way, putting our skills together, is why we do it. It's a very mission-driven business.
And you have another co-founder, Kathleen Ellison, and she was a PhD student who helped develop the ultra-dense microarray chip in your lab. Was there a specific moment or milestone when it stopped feeling like an academic project and started feeling like the basis of a true platform company?
I think the magic moment was, and the one that probably closed the Eli sale, was when we had our first novel molecule discovery. And so Kathleen's absolutely incredible and started in the project day zero and led a lot of the work in the lab. And we reached this moment where we were able to do millions of molecules and search for new solutions. And we had an academic partner who brought a novel target, and we were able to hand back, our first sort of validated hit that was able to engage and drug this previously undrugged and novel target. And we were like, oh, this whole thing works. The future for this is scale, being able to intersect the large data sets we can generate with compute, with AI, and then, obviously experts in the field to tie it all together and deliver medicines. And so that was really the moment that it became real. We knew we needed to take it out, that it didn't belong in academia anymore, and that we needed Eli's partnership to lead the financial side and the integration of it all. So it's been, that was the moment.
Biologics have dominated venture capital investment for over a decade, and yet small molecules still make up most approvals. For the transcribed audience, which is, you know, a lot of scientists, but not necessarily chemists, what's the enduring advantage of small molecules, and why is it worth reinventing the way that they're discovered?
Hopefully this podcast grows your chemist audience. We're working on it. I think the durable advantage is, you know, pretty straightforward, which is just the ease of administration, manufacturing, and distribution.
Sure.
Right? So small molecules.
Take a pill.
You have to figure out how to make it. But once you figure out how to make it, you can scale it to enormous quantities, right? Think about how cheap like Advil is, you know, at the end of the journey. But you distribute it in a pill, can carry it in your pocket. You can take it on your journey to Korea and back, and it's no problem at all. Versus biologics, you know, we've come a long way in distribution, packaging, administration, but they're still inherently more complex to manufacture, harder to eventually distribute, you know, in the like Advil, like generic setting, and just hard to carry around the world and, you know, reach other markets. And so I think small molecules will forever probably be the most common medicines humans take just due to ease of manufacture, distribution, and taking.
And why was it worth reinventing how they're discovered, though?
So it turns out that although they are the world's most ubiquitous medicine by far, their discovery process is every bit as hard or harder than, you know, many other classes of medicine. So that we still have the industry norms of decades to fully develop, billions of dollars to fully develop, 10%, you know, success rate from clinical initiation to completion, and various guesses of just how bad it is before that. Mm-hmm. You know, some, everyone knows most early projects don't even make the clinic. So like your total success rate is like 1%. For a $1 trillion plus potential market, and also the health of millions to billions of people. So it's an easy one to look at and realize like that's got to change, right? This is the path to, you know, global health and wellness, and yet it's so hard still. And so we're at this moment where the data and the AI and the compute tools are ready to radically transform that success rate and the cadence of these molecules moving. And so we're really excited about it.
Yeah, talk to me about the AI opportunity. Is it fundamentally different in chemistry versus biologics, especially given the vastness of the chemical space?
Yeah, they're really interesting. They're related, but very different problems in the sense that the big difference is the search space, like you asked about, and also the data generation piece to train and retrain models. And so search space, antibodies are fascinating and a good setting for AI to begin because they're kind of, in a sense, a sequence of letters. Of course, mm-hmm. those letters are amino acids, but there's a constrained space. There's a linear build of it. The combinatorial space is vast, but you can sort of probe it computationally. Small molecules, as you noted, the search space is ultimately infinite because you can go a different way off any given molecule and add what you want. And then you pair that with the fact that biology is able to make and test large numbers of antibodies quite rapidly.
Yep.
And so you can build a model, collect large data set, retrain the model, go, 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 and use reinforcement learning to get where you're going quite efficiently now. Small molecules, you know, prior to our work and others, it was, oh, here's a prediction. We got to call the chemist and make like 10 things or 20 things to test this idea. And so, you know, the modern world of AI and compute doesn't really work if you don't have large, precise, iterative data. And so the small molecule challenge is how do you develop technology and workflows to feed these models data at scale? And that's what we've done at Terray, of course, is develop this experimental platform that allows us to, you know, measure billions of interactions and then pair it with automation to follow up with thousands and tens of thousands of measurements. And so I think that's the key differentiation of small molecules is you have to have disruptive hardware to get to the data sets, whereas in biologics, you can use biology to get to them.
Yeah, so you've described Terray's evolution as, you know, just like you said, a hardware revolution, then a data revolution, and finally a compute revolution. So we've talked about the hardware. What unlocks the other stages?
Yeah, so the hardware was that core discovery all the way back from the academic lab, you know, proprietary technology we patented, brought out, where we're able to make these ultra-dense microarrays and measure billions of interactions between small molecules and protein targets of interest. And so that's allowed us to build the data revolution. It comes straight from the hardware. Mm-hmm. Where
how much more dense are is your hardware sort of than sort of prior generations, or was this something that people weren't even doing before?
Yeah, so we would say probably the closest technology before us would be the inkjet printed microarrays.
Okay.
And so if you think about the miniaturization factor, it's something around 10,000 fold. So what fits on our little ultra-dense microarray the size of a fingernail would have previously fit on like half a tennis court.
Wow. So okay.
It's an incredible compression in size, acceleration in speed, and reduction in cost. And so it really unlocks a wholly new chemistry data set that didn't exist before.
Okay.
And so you go from that hardware innovation to then having a data set that lets you map, to your question about chemistry space, it lets you map these dark areas of chemical space that no one's really been in before, mm-hmm. and find these novel starting points to really, really hard problems. And then from there, you can kick into the AI piece of our workflow, where we're able to generate structures against a desired set of properties, predict fully the sort of property package for those molecules, and then select the optimal ones for testing. And so we've built the business sort of in that sequence. You know, we started with the hardware innovation and invention, used it to generate this data revolution to find ways to start where others can't, and then built the AI revolution on top of that to leverage all these novel starting points we're identifying and take them all the way through for ourselves and our partners. And so, you know, our data set we use to work in those dark areas of chemical space is 40 times larger than the entire public chemistry data set. And we measure, you know, a billion new measurements every quarter. So we're accelerating away. And so it's really just a wholly different like data set and ability than what's out there before our work. And yeah, to try and brute force that skill, I mean, you'd be bankrupt long before you got there.
Yeah. Which phase was the hardest?
The next one.
What's the next one?
I think it's one of the things you learn building a business, right? Is that I thought when we walked into the first incubator, bare desks, you know, a hope and a plan and a couple people, I was like, this is the hardest it's going to be. We got to go raise like
it's only going to get easier, dollar. Huh?
It's only going to get easier. We're going to raise this money, going to grow the team, get some more experts, and then boom, boom, boom. And, you know, it's incredible because with every opportunity comes the next challenge. Like our platform is now delivering, you know, so consistently novel starting points and progressing them to, you know, attractive molecules for clinical translation that we have a breadth of clinical translation opportunity that's just never really been experienced in a small startup company before.
Sure, the bottlenecks change. Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously we need the capital, the partnership, the ability to move all of those. And so the business building, it's always the next one. You know, the wealth of success just brings a new challenge and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's my number one founder lesson is like, it turns out
it doesn't get easier.
It does not.
You get better though.
You do.
So the scale of Terray is astronomical, as you've talked about, you know, billions of binding measurements from these, I think you said fingernail sized chips, inside your lab is almost the size of a football field, right?
Uh-huh.
So like what's physically happening in that space and how have you industrialized the entire process? Like what does operating at the scale even look like?
Yeah, this is one where you might get me answering too long. I love obviously the underlying science came from our work, but to sort of zoom in and then back out, we do have this highly automated lab, which includes the sort of football sized field that you're describing where we have automated microscopy systems reading these ultra dense microarrays 24/7. And then we have upstairs, another football field, which looks like a highly automated chemistry and biology lab to follow up then on the most interesting molecules and move them through other assays. And so downstairs in the ultra-dense microarray field, you have combinatorial libraries built on nanoscale beads that get deposited into those little chips. And so you immobilize 32 million molecules per tiny little chip. You identify where all the molecules went on one automated system and then move it to the other system where you're able to then read the binding interaction between a target of interest and all 32 million molecules in less than 5 minutes. And so you can think of this as a, you know, factory setting, basically, where you're moving hundreds to thousands of chips, you know, in and out, reading the measurements with the targets of interest, whether it's for our internal pipeline focused on immunology or our partnerships, BMS, Gilead, co-development with Odyssey, or the completed work with Calico, where you're solving problems for others. And so it's a very much a sort of factory setting where targets move through, the data is read, it's all put up into the cloud and work, you know, computed on to find those novel starting points. And then you have the upstairs where you have the robotic and automated system that's then remaking the most interesting molecules and flowing them through all the assays of greatest interest. And then as the AI drives, you know, making the new molecules to continue the process. And so it's a pretty fascinating setup where you're intersecting a high amount of automation, technical innovation, and then obviously the compute and AI to pull the data out, drive decisions off of it, and come back.
Fully automated? Like,
I don't think anybody's fully automated yet. There's absolutely, we have a, you know, wonderful team of really expert scientists, and there's a key role still for, and I think there will be for the foreseeable future, to talented people to both solve problems that the robots can't solve yet.
Sure.
And also, you know, make sure that the right things get to the right spots within the automated flows. And so we work with a lot of automated workstations, but we do not have like a fully autonomous, you know,
human in the loop, semi-autonomous. Sounds pretty compelling.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, exciting opportunity there is that as you continue to learn, it gets more and more efficient and more automated. But there'll be a role for our talented scientists for a while yet.
Totally. So earlier you mentioned you have the largest global database of binding data by orders of magnitude. But one thing that I noticed that you said is that AI is only transformative when the data is specifically large, precise, and iterative. Why those three qualities specifically? Why are they critical, and what breaks down if one is missing?
Yeah, when we think about AI, we think about the fact that it's absolutely sort of revolutionary when it knows the rules and has the data. So you think about activities, right, like obviously coding, writing legal documents, building a website. Like, these are human defined rules. Like, you can tell it this is what how this works. You can give it a huge data set that it can train on, and then unbelievable.
Easy and cheap to verify.
Compression. I think by definition, when you do novel discovery like we do, and you're looking for previously totally unknown structures to solve problems that people can't solve, basically by definition, the rules and the data are missing in the beginning.
Yeah.
And so you have to build a process where the AI can make hypotheses basically about the rules, propose the data to test that, and you have to close the loop with large, precise data to retrain and reinforce those models until they get into the area where, you know, they begin to truly understand those factors and the acceleration takes off.
So is the AI just starting with like the foundational rules of chemistry, basically?
It's starting with the sort of learned rules of, how small molecules and proteins interact from what we know today, which means that if you're trying to solve a problem we've already kind of solved, it's very, very quick and efficient. And so I think it's a reason you see a lot of work in sort of Me Too follower development with AI, because it's very, very powerful working in areas where there's already rich patent data or other data out there. We don't do that. We find completely novel scaffolds for hard problems, start from the very beginning from zero and bring them all the way through. And so we leverage the general learnings of the rest of the field, but we have to pair that with our novel experimentation at scale to find those like dark areas of chemical space to start from. And so you use sort of the learned rules about what a finished molecule looks like to help guide your brand new stuff, but you have to have the brand new stuff and the experimentation in the loop to really bring it all the way through.
In the field of AI-driven drug discovery, we seem to be in this like war of models. And I think it's probably even difficult for scientists in the field to keep up with all the innovation happening. How do you think about a competitive edge or moat for emerging biotechs? Like, what do you make of what's happening? Like, is it the models or is it something else?
It's an and. Right. It's absolutely the models. We're very proud of the unique full stack that we've built with the underlying foundation model, which we call Kawadi, which is trained on over a billion structures and allows us to very smoothly encode, traverse, decode chemical space. And on top of that, then we built three unique modules around synthetically accessible generative structures, which I think is one of the key unlocks in the field. A predictive model that's 27 times faster than others with best in class accuracy, and a unique selection model to make the optimal set every time. Because you wind up with a really interesting problem in the age of AI, which is, I call it like AI abundance. So you get to the end, and if you're in late stage discovery, you have a chemistry team waiting who can make, I don't know, 50 molecules, say. And you have AI generation of 10,000 really interesting molecules.
That, how do you pick?
Yeah. Like you have a 10,000 choose 50 problem. And so solving that optimally is actually really important. All that said, with how proud we are of the leading position in model side, none of that will be the durable moat without the ability to connect it back to the workflow and to the large precise data at scale to then train those models and keep them going. And so I think the durable moat is being at the intersection of experimentation and AI and pairing those large novel data sets with best-in-class model tools, and that you actually learn what a real best-in-class model is by doing it yourself and seeing which one really drives program progression, which one really leads to efficiencies in cycle time and compression of the discovery, and which ones are like really cool for benchmarking and retrospective use, but not really for changing your daily life.
Interesting. You just touched on this. You've got an integrated platform, wet lab and computation brought together. We just talked about Emmy sort of reflecting this approach, whereas others in the industry, if I infer correctly, are kind of more focused on just the computational models. Can you just talk about the importance of that integration?
Yeah, I think the key and the whole reason it's called Emmy, you know, experimentation meets machine intelligence, is because we feel very strongly that that durable moat, the advantage is at the intersection, that if you build models but you don't use them yourself, it's very hard to separate like real revolution from I performed better on this benchmark by like 0.04.
Yeah.
Like, maybe great, maybe not. You really need it in the hands of your scientists. And so we put all of our tools in the hands of our scientists through an easy to use interface. Everyone at Terray is using them every day. And so it's like, I guess, sort of the origin of Claude Code, where if you're using it every day and you see the impact, you're like, this is a great thing. This is the product. This is an incredible model. Like, we got to go with this. And so I don't think you can basically learn fast enough if you're only distributing your work to others.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk more about building an integrated team where you have sort of like chemists and computational scientists like working as one of you? I imagine you've got to have a lot of hardware expertise on your team as well. Like, talk to us about some of the, like, I think I understand the benefits of an interdisciplinary team, but maybe some of the challenges to making it all work and what you've learned.
It's one of the reasons that, you know, we always talk about building at the intersection at Terray, because the future absolutely lies in these intersections of workflows. Like you said, automation, robotics, also the team that executes the, you know, sort of operational efficiency of it all, the drug discovery aspect, the AI compute aspect of it, and of course, informatics. I mean, the list is very long, right? To make it all work seamlessly when you have 50 terabytes of data streaming off your automated systems every day. You need it all back in the database by the end of the day, the models, trained, prediction, back to the scientists, tested. There's a lot of moving pieces to all keep running seamlessly all the time. And we felt really strongly, as I just said, that we had to have that all together to be quick, both in our timelines of discovery and development, but also quick in our platform learnings and optimization of the AI tools. And so we've done it. We have the tools in the hands of all of our scientists. They use it all the time. They provide feedback to the other teams. You know, this is great. This is not great. This is the slowdown. And we've identified, of course, challenges in each of those. Sometimes it's an operational efficiency, literal workflow in the lab. How does A get to B, you know, quickly and high quality enough? Sometimes it is a AI, you know, model piece. Like, we've worked very, very hard on the synthetic feasibility of the generative structures, and I think have a best-in-class solution there. And the challenges, you know, one of our operating principles is context is efficient. And so it's really important to tell your counterparts why you're doing what you're doing, like how you're doing it and what you're doing about it in a way that makes sense to them on their terms. And so when you come from all different fields, you have to really spend some extra time on the communication piece, which everyone says like, yeah, no problem. But it's actually like a lot harder than you might think when you try it.
You recently released Terray's potency model, Terabind, that's 26 times faster and 20% more accurate than the leading models. What was the fundamental insight behind Terabind?
Yeah, we think a lot about the fact that what really drives small molecule development is potency, not pose, which is to say that if you're considering, say, out of our generative module, you have a million structures that have all been designed to have a desired set of properties for that target, and now you're moving to the Terabind section, and you're predicting universally potency and selectivity, so across the proteome, so basically trying to get rid of all the off-target piece mm-hmm. you might want and score it for the desired target. you don't really need pictures of all a million, like how the small molecule is, you know, fitting in the protein. And so everybody else in the field, you know, inspired by the success of AlphaFold, goes through a process where you basically first generate the picture, which is a diffusion heavy step, and then compute the potency, which means that every potency computation is constrained by having to first generate the image of how it might fit together.
Is that just computationally expensive to do?
It's quite computationally expensive because you have the sort of local, or if not the entire protein structure that you need to compute and then fit with the small molecule of interest. And so our key insight was that there's really no reason to do that when you're only interested at first in ranking how well these things are likely to work. And so we basically rearranged the sequence. And so
find the most potent stuff, then visualize and see if it's a structure that
only visualize the most interesting ones. Exactly. And so that's the 27-fold, you know, speed up. And the obvious question was like, oh, but have you broken it by switching the order? And the answer is absolutely not. You actually can make it more efficient even. And so with that, we can deploy this model on just far former structures than others can, which comes all the way back then to what I spoke about earlier, the AI abundance, where now you have thousands of molecules that are fully scored, ranked, and available.
It's not a rate limiter anymore.
And so now the rate limiter is, how do you optimally pick the right things to physically test out of your AI set of generated molecules?
You built Terabind in 2023, but you only started publicizing it recently. And one thing you said was staying quiet is not the path to victory at the moment. What shifted your thinking?
I mean, if I'm fully honest, you know, I think the recognition of Bolt shifted our thinking. We built Bolts, you know, like a couple years before, and
Bolts
we're using
before Bolts.
Yeah, using it quietly, but that doesn't really matter to the rest of the world. And we were had the, I think the question that comes up in all companies, especially new small companies, like, all right, we've set the standard for something, but it's also a trade secret and a competitive edge. You know, what's the right path? Do we keep it secret, use it ourselves and move our molecules and get ahead? Or do we tell the world? And so we initially picked the stay real quiet path. And then we saw the incredible attention on, you know, related products. And we're like, we got to tell people that we're already doing this and that we've set the standard here, because it's important to be in the conversation. And I think also where we're at now, we just spoke about the sort of totally different approach we're taking. I think it's a useful piece to the field in general to think about these other approaches and shift how they're doing the compute.
I don't want to spend too much time on models here, but Terray talks about selection models. Can you explain their role in ME and drug discovery generally?
I think selection is so fundamental and essential because it's where AI meets reality.
This is selecting which molecules to actually work with.
Yeah, this is selecting what do you actually make and test in that experimental cycle. And so for small molecule discovery, someday maybe we'll get to fully one shot straight into the clinic. But for now, that's certainly not how it works. There's a set of properties that you're going to need to develop over time, starting with potency. You know, how well does it engage the target of interest? Moving through selectivity, how does it avoid off-target, potentially toxic interactions? And then ADME properties, how well does it distribute in the body? Does it get where it's going? Is it stable? What's the excretion profile? And so as you move through development, typically you continue to add properties. And so you're going to do multiple cycles and you need to make the optimal set of molecules each cycle. And so with AI and the ability to leverage our incredible data sets, we keep coming to these moments of physical testing with far more options than we can physically test. Our ultra-dense microarray gives us an opportunity to be unique and test millions at times. But when you're into late stage experiments like animals, you're still back to small numbers. And so we need a module that optimally hedges the selections there. And so ME-Select does that. It computes the underlying uncertainty of the predictions and then builds you an optimal set of things to test where the risks are essentially anti-correlated. So if molecule one doesn't work, molecule 20 probably does work. And this radically compresses discovery times and saves, you know, months and months and months and millions of dollars to get you where you're going.
Awesome. That makes sense. So you started as a platform company, and now your first candidate is expected to enter the clinic next year. Congrats.
Thank you.
Was building your own pipeline always part of the plan?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's been a mission in my life to bring you know, new cures and benefits to people's health. I've been after it for a while now, all the way through my academic career and now through the company. And so I'm so excited that we're going to be in the clinic and begin to test our novel medicines for people. And I think ultimately it is the maximal value realization for transformative technology like ours that lets you crack and solve these totally unsolved problems that have been out there forever. And so it's always been part of the plan.
Do you think it's possible today for a biotech company just to be a platform company only, or does every platform ultimately have to become a product company?
I mean, I think there's certainly possible to be a platform only company. I mean, we certainly have seen through, you know, the last decades plus, you have software companies, you have CRO service companies. I just think that the platform to product arc with the intersection of AI and experimentation has such an incredible value unlock for solving these impossible problems and delivering first-in-class medicines that are worth billions and billions of dollars and change millions of lives, that it's, like, it's why just the you? Preferred path.
Yeah, why but wouldn't you?
You could do the other ones, and people will.
Let's talk about some of your partnerships. You work with BMS, Calico, Gilead, and others, but your internal pipeline is focused on immunology. Like, how do you decide what to advance yourself versus to partner out?
Yeah, we've been really fortunate to be, I think, the AI-driven drug discovery partner of choice, as you mentioned, with Calico, which is completed, Gilead, BMS ongoing. We also have an interesting 50-50 co-development with Odyssey, where they brought some really unique biology and expertise to the collaboration. We brought some really unique expertise in chemistry to the collaboration. We're working together on that target. But we think about identifying and working with our partners to solve problems that they otherwise couldn't solve. And so we've repeatedly succeeded where commodified methods have not. And so our partners universally basically bring us targets that when we see them for the first time, we're like, huh,
never seen that one before.
I bet that's hard. And we've been able to deliver novel chemical equity and progress it against them. And so typically there's not a conflict because they're working out in sort of vanguard target space that we're not aware of without them. And so we've been able to deliver for them time and time again. It's been fun and exciting, and a way to see Terray Molecules move where the back end capital and development is, you know, shared or largely somebody else's.
Totally. You mentioned that Terray deliberately avoids highly published or well-mapped chemical spaces. I think you even used the term dark earlier. What's driving this strategy?
We think about, to your earlier question, like, where's the durable moat? And so there's an inherent trait. It's certainly quicker to follow known chemical matter and make variants of it to address some problem with the original matter. And so you see many companies in that space. But we also see that many, many companies can build models that are efficient in those settings, as well as the rise, of course, of fast-following ecosystems, which include the obviously Chinese setting today. And so if you're working in those spaces, I think the moat over time is really shrinking. It's very, very hard, very, very competitive. It's going to be a constant game of, can you be first mover? Can you squeak through all of them? There's going to be 8, 10 in every race. And so we work alone. We work out in targets and discovery challenges where our chemical equity is totally novel and unique. And if you solve it, you're all by yourself for quite a while, and you have a durable moat for your programs and for your value.
Are there any areas today where AI drug discovery models still fail in ways that only a experienced medicinal chemist is going to be able to detect?
I don't think only an experienced medicinal chemist can detect the failure, because when it doesn't work, it's pretty clear. You put it in the assay and it comes back no instead of yes. I think the interesting thing, sort of thematically to everything we talked about today, is there are generation of sort of seed data sets that today the experienced medicinal chemist plays just a fundamental essential role, which is to say, when you get to a property for which it's the model is not as performant owing to the complexity of that measurement or the scale of the data available for that measurement. We're now talking, we've moved far away from our 15 billion measurements and early discovery. We're into unique later stage properties. Figuring out what the right sort of seed data to start the iterative cycle with is, absolutely an expertise-driven step. And I think all of our work, the experienced medicinal chemists, our team is incredible, play a key role because, for example, going back to selection, when the optimal basket of molecules to make is suggested, there is a human training and selection step where they then say, like, you picked these eight structures, but actually these two, I don't think so. And then it'll recompute and come back with a better basket and also learn for next time, like, these are undesired for these other reasons. So there's definitely a scientist in the loop model refinement piece that's essential to what we do.
Have you been surprised by any blind spots the medicinal chemists have that models have proven them wrong on?
Yeah, I mean, it's really exciting. Our most advanced program has this really uncommon motif in it that when it first was suggested, everybody was like,
it's not going to work.
Like, I don't know about that one. But because we're built at the intersection, our teams, you know, are built to try these tools and supportive. They're like, we got to, like, this is scored so highly and so consistently. Like, we have to see this. And it turned out to be an incredible breakthrough for the program. So I think there's, you know, very much a role for both sides today. And as the learnings grow, obviously you accumulate the information in the models and they continue to perform better and better.
There's a growing camp that sort of argues the physical lab is becoming a liability. It's going to get automated away. It'll all happen in silico. Physical experiments are expensive, slow, et cetera, et cetera. What's your case for the other side?
I just don't know how we're going to get all the way there. You know, we work in an industry that's highly regulated as well as, you know, experimental proof based. Mm-hmm. And so you're certainly at a minimum going to have to make and test it, you know, once and prove that it works. And it's interesting. I was in a conversation recently with somebody who simulates like the building and use of lasers.
Okay.
And so they only do build it like once or twice. And it all comes back to what I was talking about, which is they know the rules and they have the data. So like they literally know before they start, this is how this circuit's going to work with this circuit. So they don't need much physical testing. If you work in de novo discovery, like I said, you don't know the rules in the beginning. And so I think for the foreseeable future, the better path is large, precise, iterative data, the Terray story, versus hoping that you can make it only once and get it done. That I think lies outside of this novel discovery space, and you gotta have the integration with the wet lab to solve the problem.
So it's fair to say you're in like the Jevons paradox of wet labs, where as our like simulation and machine learning tools get better, we'll probably wanna do more experiments, higher probability of success.
I think you're gonna want to, but the key is gonna be, you know, continued version of the Terray story where you then invent novel workflows or novel hardware that takes that measurement cost and cycle time down to where it's doable and you can generate the type of data sets these models really thrive off of. And so, you know, that's something we continue to focus on at a low intensity in Terray, is like, how do you continue to expand what you can measure at tremendous scale?
Many of the frontier model companies are in sort of the tech world are now moving into healthcare and life sciences. What's your view on like the role of LLMs in drug discovery?
I think they're incredible opportunity for orchestration. So what we've seen and what we're looking at with collaborators is that you probably cannot just ask a straight frontier LLM like, hey, what molecule does this? Because these models are not actually very performant in the small molecule chemistry space. But if you give them access to expert tools like ours, they can be incredible orchestration of those tools, building optimal workflows, closing the loop. And so I think that's the incredible opportunity for those tools. In the same way that, you know, Claude will use a calculator to do arithmetic because that's the most efficient way to call the tool use, it can orchestrate the use of our generate, predict, select. You know, these types of frontier models are incredibly powerful with the right tools in their hands.
That is a perspective we at Benchling very much agree with. What do you expect to see in 12 months when it comes to AI drug discovery? We're now entering prediction territory here. Let's do one.
That's
year.
That's good. My crystal ball is perfect. All right. I always get it right.
What's it say for 12 months from now?
I think 12 months from now, you'll start to see things that you just talked about start to become common. So like agentic orchestration of workflows. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see the continued evolution of our work and others where the models are more and more performant in the predictive space, and a huge emphasis in our world on synthetically practical generative structures. And so as generation and generative AI came to small molecules, it arrived with a huge promise, but was really constrained by the fact that it would suggest molecules to make that took forever. And so it wasn't really practical. And so we've built a leading module, and I'm sure others are hard at work too, where you can then constrain the synthetic space that these generate into. And so I think every generative module will be synthetically constrained in 12 months. The timeline to access generative structures will compress radically. Predictive tools will get better, and all of it will be agentically orchestrated.
Does your crystal ball have any insight into 10 years from now?
10 years from now is going to be wild. There are going to be so many more molecules being developed and being ready for clinical testing than prior generations that I think it's going to call for a real reconsideration of how we move things through the clinic and how we capitalize the whole industry. It's really an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, it's exciting. So looking back on the Terray journey, do you have any advice for yourself when you were getting started or for new biotech founders? Anything you wish you knew when you started the company?
We touched on some of them. So I would say quick list. One, the next step is always the hardest and the funnest.
Yeah.
Two, whatever you pick to start on is actually your business probably.
I actually really agree with that. I never believe when people are like, I'm going to do A, then B. Like A, then B doesn't exist. It's just A.
That is correct. 100% A. And if you say we're in our world, we're going to start with this target just to show the platform works. And then we'll come back and pick the real things we work on.
Never happens.
You're actually just working on whatever you started working on.
I think that's an important lesson. Both of those are important lessons. The first one though I think about is it's good to lie to yourself so that you actually get started. Or if you knew how hard it was, would you even start?
Oh, yeah, that one's probably always true. we work in a tough business. Making new medicines is
it's an important one, though.
We're incredibly rewarding, but high capital business.
Absolutely. Anything else?
I don't know. There's probably some others, but that's what stay calm, keep working. You're good.
Amen. All right, lightning round time. These are fun. They're rapid fire. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. No wrong answers. In your opinion, what's the most game-changing medicine of the last 100 years?
Oh, we're still in the window, so it's got to be penicillin. That one will age out, but come on.
Oh, we're getting close, actually.
We're close. Right? We're a few years away. Then I'll have to change my answer to something like Humira or whatnot.
You can wave your wand and have a cure for anything. What do you pick?
This one's so personal right now. I would cure rheumatoid arthritis.
Okay.
Which also intersects with the mission of Terray, although that's not why we work in immunology.
What's something you and your brother were competitive about as kids?
Everything? I don't know. Probably our dumbest idea was indoor tackle football. We fortunately matured through that one.
Who's your all-time favorite baseball player? Are you a big baseball guy?
I'm a huge baseball guy. My favorite sport is baseball by far. I'm going to have to go with Mookie Betts because he's shared between me and my kids. So I'm a lifelong Boston Red Sox fan.
Okay.
Grew up outside Boston. I live in LA now. My kids are ardent Dodgers fans to my acceptance. And Mookie, of course, due to the foolish Red Sox ownership, moved from one to the other. And I love Mookie. Plays every position. Incredible hitter. Great teammate. I love Mookie.
All right. Who should we interview next on Transcribed?
There's so many fun ones. I always learn a lot when I talk to John Maraganore, who's one of our advisors. I think his journey through the industry and breadth of perspective is really cool. And then locally, I think Al Bors, who ran Protomer, bought by Lilly.
Oh, great idea.
Has had a really interesting journey from small startup to the biggest pharmaceutical company in the world.
Yeah, both ends of the spectrum. Amazing. Jacob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been really fun.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.